Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 208, Love and Marriage Advice from the Buddha.
Defined in Buddhism. The word is called Maitri. And which relates to two words in Sanskrit, Mata, which is mother, and Mitra, which is friend. And so Maitri, and in Pali, those of you who know some, have bumped into like some Vipassana thing, they talk about Metta, which is this Pali word. Because Pali language, they don't like consonant clusters. So they simplify my tree to metta. And it's translated often as loving kindness. But it really is just love. The reason they, in English translations, they use the word loving kindness is that they heard about love from, you know, Christian missionaries and colonialists in Asia. And then they didn't think they were too loving to them. So they want to get put in the kindness part, which for which you can't blame them, I think. And so it is love. And it's defined as the wish for the happiness of the beloved. So in our Western terminology, you know, it's more agape than eros, if you know a little bit that thing. In other words, more altruistic or selfless love than it is necessarily erotic desire. Then, but in India in general, and the compassion fits with it, in that compassion means the will to relieve others' suffering. So love is the will to have to their happiness, the happiness of others, and compassion is the will to remove their suffering. So compassion is not simply empathy, it's not just feeling their suffering, although maybe it's based on that, but it goes along with the wish to have them be free of that suffering, and a kind of a impulse toward them to help them be free of that suffering, compassion does. And therefore love also has the will to make them happy, have them be happy. So I like to add to that, which people don't usually do when they do it, that in other words, to actually really love, and to actually therefore really be compassionate, a person has to have some happiness themselves. They have to already have some kind of bliss or happiness, some sort of capacity for that. Because how would you want another person to feel happy if you don't know what feeling happy means? A. And then, if you want to help them free themselves from suffering, if you don't have a feeling of what freedom from suffering would be like, how would you really... You would be sympathetic to someone, oh, I'm sorry, you're suffering. But you would be sort of subliminally assuming that there's no way of changing that, if you follow me. In Buddhism, this is called, there's a psychological thing where all emotional feelings like that toward others connect to a level of understanding, or they would put it a level of wisdom. So compassion, they have a notion that, the notion of I don't like it that you're suffering, combined with ignorance, what they call ignorance, misknowledge, is actually not true compassion. Sometimes they can call it sentimental compassion or conceptual compassion, but it has no power, no strength to help another. You know, it's just like a pity kind of thing, like, I'm sorry for your state, but you're just stuck with it. I have no idea. Nothing's going to be done about it, if you follow that. Does that make sense?
Because they don't know.
What?
Because they don't know it, they don't have that experience of it.
Well, yeah, or also because they have the ignorance means that In the Buddhist sense, ignorance means that you think of things as being fixed in the state that they that you perceive them as being in. It means your mind sort of is like you, however you see it, you think that's what it is. You know, you don't have a, you haven't had a kind of experience that things are never quite what they seem to be. So therefore, when you see someone in pain, you think that's just what they are.
Unless you experience that pain.
Unless you experience it, but unless you realize that there may be some other capacity in them other than the pain. You follow me? It's like a doctor. You know, a doctor who only is focused on the sicknesses. Mm-hmm. People come to them and they say, oh, here comes the tuberculosis. Oh, here comes the cancer. Oh, here comes a neurosis, high blood pressure. They don't say, here comes a marvelous human being with incredible sensitivities and capacities for blooming energy, who is afflicted with something that is preventing them from being their real self. In other words, a doctor who sees the potential health in the patient is very different from a doctor who can only see the sickness. And that's why they say it goes along with a certain level of wisdom. And for example, the first level of wisdom, they usually connect to a knowledge of impermanence, meaning the constant changeability of everything. So in other words, then when you feel the suffering of another, you also feel the potential of their being free of that suffering. So then your will to their freedom from it seems to have a target. You know what I mean? You feel that you can free them from suffering, or they can be free of that suffering. Similarly, if love is wishing them to be happy, you see them some potentially free of the suffering and see them potentially happy. And actually, they have a concept that love, we have that concept in our popular culture. They say that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So that means someone is gaga in love with somebody else, and then that person looks really beautiful to them, and not necessarily to someone else, you know. So, the Buddhists agree with that, and they say that when you even imagine another person as happy, they look beautiful to you. So in other words, when you love them, you sort of see that beauty that's in there, and although maybe they're grimacing with the pain or there's a problem, so you see that, and underneath that there is a potential happiness, a potential beauty about them, something like that. So anyway, the thing about marriage advice, you know, Buddhists are not good about that in general. There's this wonderful story about the great
rats.
But they don't perform marriages, for example. Buddhist monks did not. And Buddha was very careful in forming his order, his community, of people seeking freedom and enlightenment, that they did not infringe on priestly livelihood roles. So he told his mendicants, we call them monks now, but they weren't really monks, they were mendicants. Bhikshu means a mendicant, someone who lives on alms, you know, others feed them.
Right.
They go and ask for lunch. Free, it's based on the free lunch. The Buddhist community was based on the idea of free lunch, which is why it could only happen in a rich country like India in those days. The richest of the Eurasian communities were the Indian ones. And because of tremendous agricultural wealth there in those river valleys. And there's a famous story in Tibet, Atisha, who was a Bengali and a really great master. I mean, he taught one marvelous thing, wrote great books, and he had a huge impact in Tibet in the 11th century. And the kings of Tibet and queens who had invited him were pestering him and the nobles there and others about advice for their marriages. They wanted his advice, and he kept saying, I don't give that advice. I'm a monastic, I'm a mendicant, I'm a celibate, so I don't really know about these issues, and I don't give such advice. And they kept pestering and pestering. So finally he said, all right, you want some marriage counseling, couples therapy? They said, yes, we want that. He was a very enlightened person, so he said, okay, here it is. Husband and wife, each of them will soon be dead. Therefore, while still alive, they should be more kind to each other. Which I mean, that's a very Buddhist thing, in the sense that in Buddhism, being aware of death, having death as a witness, or having death as an advisor, you know, like Don Juan in the Carlos Castaneda books used to say, take death as your advisor makes you much more alive, of course, because you realize you are alive and you're not dead yet, and you should therefore, you know, live the moments to the fullest, make the best of them, and this kind of thing, you know what I mean? Which I think is really, I love that actually myself. I think that's the best matter of life. He didn't, other than that, I don't know what else he elaborated. Except, but I know, the other thing is, Buddha himself and the whole Buddhist teaching was based on Buddha's discovery that happiness is a natural state of beings. Actually, this is very confusing for people because people think, well, Buddhism is based on everything is suffering. You know, because the first noble truth is suffering, truth of suffering. But that's the misunderstanding that is around there, you know. So the thing is, Buddha's discovery was not suffering. It doesn't take a Buddha to discover suffering. We all easily can discover it. And we do all the time. What Buddha discovered was that the reality of life, if you really understood where you do, you know, you're special, where you're coming from, or where anyone is coming from, anyone who really understood it, according to Buddha, who claimed to have really understood it, is that life is bliss, actually. Life is nirvana, the third noble truth. In the four noble truths, do you all know the four noble truths? He was looking at some people, four or five people, who hadn't had a square meal in 5 years, they hadn't shaved, they hadn't washed, they hadn't eaten, they were really in bad shape. He looked at them and he said, "This is suffering." Again, a very common sense statement to that group. So the unenlightened life of suffering, when he elaborated, it was clear. The ignorance-dominated life, the misknowledge, misunderstanding-dominated life. Second one is the cause of the suffering, the origination of the suffering. Third one is the freedom from the suffering, you know, nirvana. And the fourth one is the path to the freedom, you know, what's called the Eightfold, Noble Eightfold Path. And so it's a medical diagnosis. He's not, the medical diagnosis is not, unless it's a really bad prognosis, the medical diagnosis is not that the recognition of the symptom is not the fact. That's just dealing with the problem. It's noticing there is a problem. Then the diagnosis is to analyze the cause of the problem. And the prognosis is the key thing. Can there be a cure? And Buddha's discovery was the prognosis. That the reality of life is the freedom from suffering.
Greetings and salutations, podcast Wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa's Valentine's Gathering with Robert and Nena Thurman, held in Phoenicia, New York in 2015. This intimate dialogue between Tibet House co-founders Robert and Nena Thurman was recorded fireside in Menlo's Lhasa Inn in the heart of the Catskills in Phoenicia, New York. First part of the podcast was an overview of Buddhism and an introduction to the Four Noble Truths. Professor Thurman picks up this topic in the second half and then shares humorous stories from the Tibetan tradition and anecdotes from his experience of being married to the dynamic managing director of Menlo Retreat, Nena Thurman. To learn more about their work at Menlo Retreat, please visit menlo.us. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. to learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including discounts on tuition at programs in New York City and upstate New York at Menlo Retreat, please visit tibethouse.us. In addition to your monthly support, your online participation as a subscriber to the Bob Thurman podcast helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture in the West. The Tibet House US is located two blocks west of Union Square in New York City and is His Holiness's cultural embassy in the United States. If you're in the New York area, be sure to visit Tibet House in person. It's a great experience. There's a gallery space, bookstore, and events in the evenings. Visit Tibet House's website for more information. Interstitial music for the Bob Thurman podcast is generously supplied by Tenzin Chogyal. To learn more about the music and work of Tenzin Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. For information on the music specifically used in this podcast, look in the links in the description. They're listed there. And now, the second half of this week's episode with a reading of the poetry of Walt Whitman by Gary Gott. Enjoy.
There, in Buddhism, there's two realities. There's real reality and unreal reality. An unreal reality means a reality that is somewhat real, but it's never quite what it seems to be. You're like an illusory, not illusion completely, but an illusory reality. You know, right? When you look at yourself in the mirror, or you look in the mirror and you see a three-dimensional space in the mirror, what you see is a reality. You're seeing a reflection of a three-dimensional space, but it looks like the three-dimensional space is in there, and of course it isn't. So in that sense, it's unreal. That aspect of it is unreal. So that's unreal reality, if you follow me. So the ignorance-dominated perception is one that sees things in its slightly distorted way, like looking in a mirror. And but nirvana is what really is, and if what you understand, that's how you see everything as nirvana. And then he lets some people think that nirvana was some other place. You know, like you leave this world and you go to another place. But he himself basically clearly stated that that's not what he meant. He let them think that because they think that it would be impossible for this to really be bliss, for the reality of this to be bliss, because there's too much suffering in their on our normal perception of things, you know. So people wouldn't believe that. So he let those kind of people, but some people can get it, the other thing, which is that if you experience this world as it really is, you will feel blissful yourself. Yes. Some people can't get that. But for those, he talked what's called non-duality, which means that the reality of this is what it really is. And then when you see it wrongly, you manage to suffer in the midst of bliss. You manage to turn that bliss into suffering through your ignorance, if you follow me. Now, the ignorance itself is defined. This has everything to do with couples. The ignorance itself is defined as the perception of yourself as being some sort of absolute and feeling that you are a real reality, not an unreal reality. And therefore, when you think you're the real reality, you're put in a position of automatic conflict with the rest of the world, because the other people don't think you're the real reality. They think they're the real reality. So you're all in a disagreement with the world, and the world is a lot bigger than you. And hey, world, I'm the real reality, and they forget you, you're just whatever. And each of us is the real reality. Then you have, you know, under stressful circumstances, you have the Hobbesian, you know, war of all against all, what they call, you know, which is the cause of all the trouble. So that's ignorance. That's the cause of the suffering, you know, the distorted, the exaggeration of the sense of self. And then they have a greater subtlety about it. It's also an exaggeration of the sense of the self of other things. In other words, thinking that other things are really themselves some sort of absolute different thing than you. So there's a call, like a self of things, an objective self. So what enlightenment is not an experience that you don't exist at all. That's another way it's misunderstood. You think that the big goal of enlightenment is to just disappear. You know, and then people in the modern world, people go, wonder why that's such a big deal. They automatically do this, just shoot themselves. They don't have to go to a Zen center for 30 years. Just shoot yourself and you disappear. They think that they don't have the idea of the continuity of life. You know, modern people don't. But although the Buddha did, and modern people should, actually, that's another topic. But the point is, in the state of couples, if each one of the couple thinks they're the main thing of the couple, it's not going to work out well, obviously, because they're going to disagree with each other at a root level. And temporarily, there's kind of that thing where they fall in love, and each one tells the other, and maybe feels, oh, you're the greatest thing. And then each one, at some level, is really amazed that I've been going on all this time, and ever since Mom, nobody thought I was the greatest except me. And now somebody agrees with me. Wow. And when each one agrees with the other, it's really a flip out. And that's why Romeo and Juliet, everybody else hates them. Because they're both agreeing with each other in their mutual narcissism. They're fitting together temporarily. You know? But that, unfortunately, doesn't last. It's like, Mom thought you were the greatest for a while when she brought you out of herself. And then after a while, she gets tired of mother's gold, and, you know, it's like...
30 years
later. You know, and sooner or later, she says, you know, she still loves you, but it never loses that, luckily, but, you know, it doesn't really last to the same degree. So the key, therefore, is that, and from Buddhist point of view, psychologically, not religious, but psychologically, and Buddhism is more science and psychology in a way, really, in philosophy than it is really religion. That's another long story for our context. But in that context, all of the great spiritual teachings of humanity that have lasted have basically helped people diminish that sense of I'm the greatest. Whether they did it under theism, they sort of say, well, you're not so great, God is great. Love the Lord with all thy heart, and love thy neighbor as thyself. You know what I mean? They have like all these kind of commandments. Confucius also, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. He had a golden rule like that. And every single teaching has that kind of aspect. You know, Islam, if it wasn't corrupted by the Wahhabi people lately in Saudi Arabia, Islam means surrender, actually. Your ego, you know. Islam means salam, peace, surrender, you know, comes from that, you know. Salam means, you know, salam alaikum, peace be with you. But the salam part is like a salam, it's a bow, you know. It means I surrender to you, that means. And therefore we have peace, right? So because we're not competing, we're not fighting. That's what it's supposed to mean, you know. That's what it was in its initial vision of Muhammad. You know? And it wasn't killed an unbeliever at all. And so since all those things have it, therefore, in a general couples thing, you could say that for a marriage or a relationship to last really well a long time, they have to mutually have a kind of, well, they may not be enlightened in the sense of fully selfless, altruistic beings. Normally people are not, right? I don't pretend to be. But each has to have a commitment to be supporting the other in the effort to restrain that narcissistic or egotistical thing. Do you know what I mean? So that in other words, rather than we're going to carry on forever where each of us thinks I'm the greatest and I expect you to agree with me, which when the first in love is happening, maybe it works for a while. But instead of that as the commitment to start with, which will eventually lead to, you know, divorce, you know, because finally the other one will not agree enough to satisfy the egotist. But rather, there's a mutual support in my attempt to be less egotistic. And a recognition of the sort of stress of thinking of someone else as greater than me and better than me, and that there's an inner thing there that isn't quite up to that, but one is working on that. And like in the Book of Changes, it says, the I Ching, it says the relationship has to be based on a mutual spiritual coordination and sort of mutual support, like I support you in your spiritual quest as an individual, as much as I demand your focus and support of me, that thing, you know. And but that, and that that be mutual, if you follow me. So I think that's the key. In the traditional, not so traditional, but in one strand of the meditation on selflessness, on how to control that, how to come to an understanding of the nature of the self, and with the lack of a certain type of self that is like the kind that really causes an imbalance in one's life. The thing to do is to remember and to focus on a time when one has felt that way oneself, wronged. They call it the mood of injured innocence. It's a time when one can perceive how powerfully, viscerally one feels oneself is kind of like the absolute thing, they say, you know. So actually, when people are going around feeling very wronged by the world, they're really on the point of where they're in a way asserting themselves the most strongly as they possibly can. But unfortunately, if they don't have the instruction or the reflection, the teaching, that is maybe then something to try to examine what self is it that was wronged. And in a way, shift that instead of blaming outside, take some responsibility themselves about it. That's sort of a big turning point for the person. Because you actually have power over yourself. You know, you don't have power over the rest of the world. Like you're saying, you don't see how you can change that point of view, right? But you can change your point of view always, you know. And that's one thing one can do. But one tends to feel when one gets in a certain stress situation that one absolutely cannot do anything and one feels helpless. So the time of feeling terribly wronged by the world is a time just precursor of despair, because you can't really change the world, you know what I mean? So then that's really bad. You know that Thoreau, wonderful Thoreau statement, the mass of men today lead lives of quiet desperation. You know, I really like that one. It's really a good one. And it comes, so there's a strange teaching in Buddhism about, at least about oneself, that when something happens that seems very unjust, one feels very innocently wrong and misperceived. And actually in relationships that often happens, where one member of the couple thinks something terrible about the other, then the other feels like I'm right and that person is wrongly perceiving me. So then the way of gaining power over that situation is not to just insist on one's innocence, but to try to see, well, where is it that I do have responsibility in having caused this perception in the other? Even if they're wrong, if somehow there must be something about me that has caused that. So in a way, it's like blame the victim when you are the victim. When you feel victimized, you blame yourself. In the sense of not blame, not just because of the blame, but in the sense of that you can do something about that. And there's no need for despair. Now, in dealing with another who's stuck in that sort of situation, of course, it's very difficult what to do. Of course, I guess it's why they say, I mean, there are three kinds of gifts, you know, in the virtue of giving, you know, generosity. There's the gift of material things, there's the gift of safety or security or protection, and then there's the gift of teaching. And so I guess all one can do in a situation where people are feeling like that, and you feel that's obstructing them from doing anything positive in the situation, you could just give them something, but then that would just condone their sense of, you know, where you did a little something toward the world, treating them right, and might help in some case, but probably they'll still feel you didn't give enough or whatever it is. You can protect them by not attacking them further, or what they would think would be further. But the best, I guess, is teach them. And then when it's an extreme thing, the only way you can teach them is by providing example, and not reflecting back to them that you're behaving the same way they are, I guess. The only thing you can really do. And to be, it's like, it's an odd thing, but maybe someone's therefore very miserable when they feel mistreated by the world. And somehow, very tricky thing of being happy yourself. even though the world has not treated you absolutely perfectly. And this is something in the whole compassion language that I was trying to get at a little bit before, that to be really compassionate, you have to have a sense of what happiness is. To be loving, you have to have a sense of what happiness is in yourself. So in a way, to be a proper person to contribute in a loving relationship, you have to almost be like what Hare Krishna Premgai was saying, you have to be happy in yourself no matter what, even without the relationship. Then you're giving of yourself in the relationship, and you're not depending on the relationship for your happiness or something like that. So when you're encountering someone who's really stuck in this thing of they're really miserable because the world is mistreating them, in one way, the best thing you can do for them is just be really cheery yourself. I'm so sorry. Which might even annoy them more. But another way, it puts the burden on them. Like, you're cheered up, but, you know, I didn't do anything to you, but they might think you are. You're not being miserable with me, they might think. And then you'd say, well, I won't do you any good. And you can cheer up yourself, you know. It's like it shows a faith in them that there is, that they're not that bad off or something like that. Maybe that gives them encouragement to try to be less bad off or less feeling the victim. I don't know, it's a complicated thing. Unfortunately, when people feel really wrong by the world, they tend to be, when people feel despair, they tend to become violent. Is the problem. The best thing to do with that kind of situation is avoid them.
Well, that's what I was more asking based on our conversation earlier about more like hobby and third world and things. I mean, there are groups of people that just feel that the world has wronged them, and that's it's really hard to.
Yeah. Well, I actually have a very odd view. I was telling someone, I was doing an interview with someone in Belgium, but who was doing the interview for a Dutch radio or TV thing. And the Dutch are very happy. The Dutch always win the world happiness competition. But they lost this year to the Danish, because I think they had a regressive government for temporarily, I don't know. But the Dutch and the Danish are constantly competing for the happiest. Bhutan is no longer the happiest, even though they have a concept of gross national happiness, which was influential in creating a new style, a new science, in a way, in sociology and anthropology of people, scientifically trying to study like what makes people happy and not, and then in terms of nations, where is their greater happiness and not greater happiness. And somehow Dutch and Danish really are into it, I don't know why. And these are technical things, they aren't just impressionistic, you know, they have poles and ways of really studying this. And so I was doing that. And then, you know, she lived in Belgium, this person. So then Belgium is really worried, and all the European countries are, in the U.S., of these young, unemployed Muslim men, or otherwise unhappy Muslim men, who go and join the ISIS. Lots of them, hundreds of them. And they're really worried, what do we do when they come back? And I cannot understand that problem. So I was telling her quite gratuitously, and I confessed it once. I said, why is that a problem? The point is, if they decide to go join the caliphate, they should be getting caliphate passports. They don't need to keep their Belgian passport or their German or their French passport. Therefore, they don't necessarily get to come back, if you follow me. Then that's not a problem, although there will be a problem if the caliphate attacks Germany or Belgium. But to allow them to keep their passport when they've decided that they're joining a self-proclaimed country that hates all the other countries and wants to destroy them, anybody who wants to do that is welcome. But they should stay there.
They can't come back.
No, that's they right. should. Well, not with the passport. I mean, they can apply. They can apply. And then you'd have to evaluate whether they're coming back to blow you up or they're really sick of it and they've decided that was a mistake. But, you know, that they automatically come back just because they had your passport before should be no wrong.
Yeah, should be negated.
In other words, hey, guys, you're going to go fight for ISIS?
And then you give it up.
Ask the caliph for a passport if you want to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
That's what I have to say. So I was telling him, he was like, looking at me like, I wasn't asking that question. I said, well, I'm hoping you'll tell somebody in the coffee shop, maybe, who works for the ministry. I told her. You see, the materialist ideology is a very distorted one, actually, meaning that people are just their bodies, and they have no souls, and therefore they have no future life and no past life. It's a very imprisoning worldview and very unrealistic, actually, from a Buddhist point of view, or any point of view, a scientific point of view. Because it means that it's based on a distorted idea that something can become from nothing, or that something can become nothing, which is completely unrealistic. Even the materialist scientists have a law of thermodynamics that says since energy is never destroyed, it only changes form. And, it's a causal chain, you know. And life is like that, and not only the physical life, but mental life is like that. So somewhere in this great ocean of suffering beings, which Buddha also saw, and he said the recognition of it is a very important step. But then if you look into the cause of that, and then you realize that the reality of it is not that, then you don't get despaired somehow, and you find an inner happiness in yourself, and then you don't have to be dragged into every kind of suffering. So the one thing you mentioned about giving something to someone who would seem very needy and then feeling overwhelmed because you couldn't give to everybody, actually there's another angle on that sort of thing which I like to say. Like, I have a habit, I don't give that much to all this, but I try to give when I can. And I enjoy when I manage to give, because it's a little bit of a feeling of relief and release when you give something, you know, whether it's useful or not, whether it's the right gift or not. And sometimes I have a thing when I come back from my classroom in Columbia, and I'm walking down Broadway, and there's different panhandlers on Broadway nowadays. And, some of them, I know a couple of guys, they're going to definitely go and buy crack. I can tell, but they say they're hungry. But I like to give them something, and I'm almost happy to see them. It gives me a chance to give something if I have. If I don't have anything, I say I don't have anything. But if I do, I have the kind of thing, the first thing comes out of my pocket, I give them. Sometimes it's like a $5 bill, a $10 bill. I happen to have that. I didn't pre-think it, I'm going down Broadway, I better make sure I only have a single. Sometimes I have a 5 or 10, and I haven't been known to do that. And I kind of enjoy it when I trick myself into doing that. But I have been with colleagues who get actually angry, and they say, you couldn't give $10 to every one of these people, and what are they going to do with it anyway? And I said, well, excuse me, but every one of them isn't the one in front of me, A. And B, giving means whatever they do, they do. And I kind of enjoy the opportunity to give it. And then they were completely bollocks by that. They can't deal with it. This friend of mine, Protestant, nice Protestant guy. But I think that there's somehow, that's your own joy if you want to give something. And if you don't, well, you don't, because you, for some reason, you have an instinct that it's not right for that person, or you don't actually have enough at that time, or that's all right too. But, you know, the giving thing is more for the giver, as much for the giver if they really give. You can read the different Buddhist stories about people going over a sequence of lives, what they call the former life stories. You can read the Stevenson literature about children who remember their previous lives. There's a lot of evidence that we go on life after life, actually. And so, you know, you give a quarter to somebody in a good mood, and it goes with a good mood without feeling contempt for them or worry about what they can do with that quarter or anything. Just give it. And feeling good, and that little piece of opening in yourself, then given the infinity of time awaiting you to exist in many different future bodies, that becomes an ocean of wealth and generosity and joy. And in baby step, you can see in that tiny gesture an infinity of positivity, let's say. And eventually it will overwhelm the misery that's out there. And temporarily, if you look out there and say, oh, I can't give a quarter to everybody, then you will feel overwhelmed, right? But you do one baby step thing in the positive direction, even tiny, even a penny, and you feel so much better. And they will, and if it's done with a certain thing, even they'll be happy. That's a famous story that is taught about karma, where Maudgalyayana, who was a disciple of the Buddha, who had a special clairvoyance, he was very clairvoyant about people's previous lives, this and that. And he went out for his alms round, as they call it, you know, for lunch in the late morning. And he came back to the community, to the group, And he was going, alas, alas, eating his father, beating his mother, and embracing his enemy. The samsara is really hopeless. And then they said, well, what do you mean, Margarita? Why are you so upset? He said, well, I went to this house where this man was living, and he was eating a piece of fish. And he was from a fisherman's clan, and the fish was the reincarnation of his father. And then he had a dog there who was whining and wanted fish, and he was whacking it to get rid of it. The dog was the reincarnation of his mother. And then he had a child that he was like cuddling as he was eating, and the child was the reincarnation of his worst enemy, who was going to be born there to really get vengeance on him. And he's saying samsara is just so warped and so strange, it's really difficult. And they tell a story like that too. And they use that story to illustrate how we should try to love everybody, actually. Even the ones we quote-unquote love and the ones that we quote-unquote don't like. And we should equally love all of them, really. Because an enemy was our mother in a previous life. Our mother in this life was an enemy in a previous life. And the point is, all of them are potentially mothers, or we could make enemies of all of them if we behave like stupidly enough. And so, therefore, we should just love everyone. You know? That's the most sensible thing.
It's midsummer, and I'm reading a poem, To a Stranger, by Walt Whitman. Published 8 years after its final breath in 1900. To a stranger. Passing stranger, you do not know how longingly I look upon you. You must be he I was seeking, or she I was seeking. It comes to me as of a dream. I have somewhere surely lived a life of joy with you. All is recalled as we flit by each other, fluid, affectionate, chaste, matured. You grew up with me, were a boy with me, or a girl with me. I ate with you and slept with you. Your body has become not yours only, nor left my body mine only. You give me the pleasure of your eyes, face, flesh, as we pass. You take of my beard, breast, hands, in return. I am not to speak to you. I am to think of you when I sit alone, or wake at night alone. I am to wait. I do not doubt I am to meet you again. I am to see to it that I do not lose you. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.